Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Recycling trash has become a way of life for most of us over the past 30 years, so much so that it's a weekly chore that is done without much thought beyond making sure the recycling bin gets to the curb in time. Often that means recycling items that can't be recycled end up in the bin. Those contaminants end up costing you more money, and some big changes within the past 2 years overseas are changing how Americans recycle. Joining us today is Catherine Sando, who is Chief Commercial Officer with the Lancaster County Solid Waste Management Authority. Ms. Sando, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Scott.
If you have a question or a comment, we were talking before the program. There always are a lot of questions about recycling.
Oh, yes.
Give us a call 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can also leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Last summer, actually last July, because I checked, you appeared on Smart Talk to discuss the changes that Lancaster County has made to its recycling program. Now, Lancaster County was one of the first in our region to limit what can be recycled because China has stopped accepting American recyclables. And we think that's just one of the reasons.
Right.
But take us back. Why was that an issue?
Sure. So January of last year, 2018, there was a big disruption in the recycling industry. And that disruption came in the form of China, who was previously the largest importer of recycled commodities from the United States. They stopped accepting a whole variety of recycled materials, most notably mixed paper and mixed plastics. As well, they increased their regulations. They made it more stringent for the recyclables that they would accept, that they had to be much more pure, so less trash in there. And so for all intents and purposes, all of these recyclable commodities that were being exported to China all of a sudden had to stay in the United States. And so we had this overabundance of dirty materials worth nowhere for it to go. So we had to make a decision as a country, and each community responded in a different way. Some communities have suspended their recycling programs altogether. Some communities are landfilling or combusting those recyclables because they have nowhere for them to go. But in Lancaster County and in this region, we took a look and said, how do we make sure that curbside recycling is sustainable? So we instituted a program called Recycle Right Lancaster to focus on, let's capture the materials that have the most value, that have a place for them to go domestically, and let's also work with the people to keep the trash out of the recycling bin.
When you said mixed paper and
mixed plastics,
what is that, just so everyone knows?
So most people are going to think of mixed plastics as the number 3 through 7 when they look at the bottom of a plastic container and they see that recycling symbol with the number in the middle of it. And mixed paper is going to be your junk mail, your magazines, things of that nature.
Mm-hmm. So you limited what could be recycled to glass jars and bottles, metal food and beverage cans, plastic bottles and jugs with necks,
right,
and corrugated cardboard. No newspapers,
right,
plastics without necks, or other glass and metals. Why just those items?
Right. So let's start with newspaper first. When you put everything in your curbside bin, Scott, you might be a great recycler. You might empty everything out. Everything might stay clean and dry, and you only put your bin out when it's a bright, sunny day. However, there's a lot of people in this area who will put their recycling bin out irrespective of the weather. And once newspaper and paper in general, it becomes wet or soiled, it no longer is valuable. So newspaper is recyclable, just not in your curbside bin. There is a place that you can take it for drop off. And I'll tell your listeners, a great resource is going to earth911.com. Again, earth911.com. You can enter in the type of material you're looking to recycle, like newspaper. You can enter in your zip code, and it'll give you within a certain radius where you can take that material.
Is that national?
Yes, it is national. And different areas will update it in this particular area. So for instance, in Lancaster County, Lixwama updates the regional information for Earth 911.
Mm-hmm. So you made some changes over the last year,
right,
but you also went on an education campaign.
We
and
did.
When you were here last year, you were talking about that. So Update. It's been a year.
It's been a year. What have we done and how are we doing?
How did that go?
Right. So one of the most important things, we're talking about behavior change, right? We are fundamentally changing the way people think and act about recycling. So we knew it's not just about simplifying the process with the big four, those four material types, but really educating people. And we've done that in three key ways. One is a large advertising campaign. Things that you think about, radio ads, print ads, billboards, transit, as well as online ads and social media. We've also done some intensive education. So we go out to communities, and if any of your listeners are interested, we go out to businesses, church groups, civic groups, school groups, and we'll actually do presentations on recycling and really get into some more in-depth information. We also go out to community events, and we'll work with folks one-on-one and talk with them about their recycling questions. We've also moved into the schools. So we developed a recycling plan that teachers can actually use in their classroom, and it meets certain state standards as well. And we piloted this summer with a township in Lancaster County going curbside in this one neighborhood and actually giving curbside education right at the bin, looking what's in the bin and leaving a tag there, what's good, and oops, what you need to work on. And then finally, we've worked with media folks, WITF and newspaper and television, to be able to share information and get it out there. Because what we recognize is, while we've tried to simplify the process, it's actually very complex and hard for people to work through all the different nuances. So that's what we've done. And where are we at 1 year later? So this is how I'm going to anecdotally describe it, Scott. I'm going to divide this area into three groups. The first group is, I'm going to say, these are the folks who were early adopters. They're recycling right. They're passionate. They understood the issue after they worked through some questions, and they're doing the right thing. They're recycling right. The second group, I'm going to say, are folks that understood something has changed in the recycling industry. They know that there's been an upset. There might have been some changes, and they're not recycling right for a variety of reasons. They're confused. They're getting some misinformation, some different signals from different people, or they're just really busy. Life is just crazy, and they don't have the time to understand, so they're just defaulting to what they've always known. And then the third group are people who either don't know or don't care. We're not all that interested in the folks who don't know or don't care, because eventually we hope that peer influence, they'll be able to adopt the good behavior. So what we're really trying to focus on is capitalizing on the folks who are recycling right, turning them into champions, asking them to help share the message, and with the second group of folks, really delving into what are the key issues that are preventing them from recycling right.
All right. Now, when you say recycling right, I want to make sure that we define what that is. What does recycling correctly or recycling right mean?
So recycling right in Lancaster County means only putting those four material types, we call them the big four that you described, in your recycling bin, nothing else. And when you put those materials in your bin, you make sure that they're empty and that they're clean, and specifically with corrugated cardboard, that they're kept dry and that they're flat. Nothing else goes in your recycling bin. And for other communities around this area, they're going to have very similar guidelines, and it's please follow those guidelines. Don't be a wishful recycler. Do not put things in because you hope that they're going to be pulled out and recycled. They're not. What you're actually doing is harming the recycling process.
So what you're talking about is a word that you use called contaminants.
Yes.
Right? That something that is not recyclable or not accepted as being recycled
right.
in Lancaster County or other municipalities throughout
right.
the region, that those are contaminants. How
right.
much of a problem is that?
It is a huge problem, Scott. And here's why. When there is stuff, contaminants, in the recycling bin, your bin gets mixed with all your neighbor's bins and all of thousands of other people. When all that material goes to what's called a recycling processor, their job is three things. They have to sort the materials into plastics, metal, paper, so on and forth. They have to pull out all of the stuff that shouldn't be in there. And then they have to bale and sell those recyclables to someone. The more trash, the more contaminants, even if you think it could be recycled, the more stuff that's in there, the harder it is for a recycling processor to pull out. because it's mostly an automated process, then at the end, they can't get everything out. And so you're left with a lower quality material. So it really starts at the curb. We need people's help to keep that stuff out of the recycling bin. It will make the process more efficient for recycling processors so that their process can be more cost effective. Hopefully, eventually costs will go down and they can produce a more pure product that at the end, manufacturers want. Because remember, something's only recyclable at the very end if there's a manufacturer who will take those materials and turn it into something new. Doesn't matter how much you want to put it in your bin, you need someone on the back end to buy it and turn that product into something new.
I had seen a figure that like 30% of what has gone into recycling bins is, you know, it's almost a third are contaminants. Is that correct?
Yes, in Lancaster County last year, around August, late August, early September, we did what's called a single stream audit. We brought in a consulting firm and we actually took samples of this. And single stream is what you put at your curb. Mm-hmm. We did a sampling of the single stream and 30% of the materials that were in there should not have belonged. 30% contamination rate. We just repeated the same audit a couple weeks ago, and we don't have the official results yet, but we're looking at around 27%. So we've moved the needle a little bit, but your opening is spot on, Scott. We still need people. It's not caught on everywhere, and we really need people to understand how important it is that they need to recycle right.
You used the term wishful recycling.
Yes.
How did we get to that point? I mean, you also said that we wanted to make this simple. We've been doing this in Pennsylvania for most of the last
decades.
30 years.
Mm-hmm.
But how do we get to this point where so much in the way of contaminants go into the recycling bin?
So it started when recycling was first instituted. If some folks remember, there was what's called source separation. So when recycling first came to, you know, your residential neighborhood, you likely had a bin for paper, you had a bin for plastic, you had a bin for glass, you had a bin for metal. That's called source separation. And about in the early 90s, the recycling industry said, well, I should say that with source separation, it was also low participation because it was cumbersome. People had to bring out multiple bins. They had to sort things. It was a process. So the recycling industry said, how can we make it more efficient for folks and easier for folks? So what if we build our recycling plants to be able to put everything in one bin and we'll separate it at the plant? That's what came about, single stream recycling. That really came out around in the early 90s. Well, it made it easier for folks, more participation, but it also increased contamination. So the easier it was for people, they started putting things more and more and more in the bin. And we as a culture rewarded that behavior. We said, you're a good citizen, you're a good person, you care about this environment if you recycle. And so it became a badge of pride where people were so excited to say, I recycle more than I throw away. Well, what was happening is there was misperception spreading about anything that had that little recycling symbol on it. Go ahead, put it in your bin. If anything's plastic, put it in your bin. If anything's paper, put it in your bin. And we just saw contamination rates skyrocket.
What are the most common contaminants?
Greasy pizza boxes. Please don't put those in your recycling.
See, I actually had a specific question about that because obviously the paper thin ones you don't want as recyclable.
The paperboard, right?
But the corrugated ones, I always thought, oh, they're okay because they're corrugated.
Yes.
But if they have grease, you don't want them.
Right. If there's any food residue, it makes them no longer valuable because a paper mill, that's what they're doing. They're going to take the corrugated cardboard, they're going to create a pulp, and they're going to turn it into a new product. Well, if you introduce food residue on it, it's no longer valuable. Other common contaminants, please keep plastic bags and film out of the recycling bin. Do not bag your recyclables. It might be convenient for people. It might be clean, but there is no one on the back end breaking open that bag and dumping the recyclables out. If you bag your recyclables, it's going to go off the end of the line as residue, as well as plastic film. None of those plastic bags or the wrapping that goes around, like if you buy a case of water, please keep that out of the bin. That will actually bind up at the recycling processing plant. It binds up their equipment and it shuts it down. Then they have to take the whole plant down for a couple of hours to cut all that out.
Wow.
So you can return your plastic bags and film to likely a local grocery store. They have those take back programs. Mm. So dirty, corrugated cardboard, like pizza boxes, plastic film, and your other small single-use plastics. People will throw away the plastic silverware or plastic plates. None of that. Please keep that out of the bin. Mm-hmm. And please empty and rinse out your materials, because if there's a lot of food residue in there, it ruins them. It ruins the product. Mm.
What's the most unusual items that you've seen that have been that people have put in recycling bins?
Oh my goodness, Scott! It's actually so we did this audit I mentioned a couple weeks ago. We found a cat scratching post. We found our local recycling processor. They have found like animal parts. A possum, like some really gross things. There was a jar that had some empty food with maggots in it. So it can get really, really gross, some of the things that you see that people put in their recycling bin.
Possums can't be recycled?
Unfortunately, no. Mm. They can be maybe composted in your backyard, a different type of recycling.
We're going to take your questions in just a few minutes. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Check out some of the upcoming topics for Smart Talk at WITF.org/smarttalk. Some of the shows we're working on: should fire companies be able to bill insurance companies for their time and efforts? A new property tax elimination plan. And Sue Klebold, the mother of Columbine school shooter Dylan Klebold, discusses brain health, and that's coming up on next week's program. We invite you to share your questions in advance by sending us a voice memo or leaving voicemail. See what's coming up at WITF.org/smarttalk. On this portion of today's program, we're talking about recycling and the changes that have gone into recycling over the past year, not just here in central Pennsylvania, but all over the country. Our guest is Catherine Sando, Chief Commercial Officer with the Lancaster County Solid Waste Management Authority. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. We have an email from a listener who has several questions, but these are questions I'm sure a lot of people have had. Can you recycle the tops of metal cans that get cut off by the can opener?
In theory, yes. So the top of a can is made of the same material as the base. And what we like to say is, though, because of the size of it, it can likely fall through the separation process. So in Lancaster County, it's okay for the top. You can throw it in your trash because we combust the trash to make electricity out of it. And on the back end, we can remove that metal after it's gone through the combustion process.
All right. Can you recycle the lids of soda bottles?
No, you cannot. Those need to be put into your trash. They're made of a different type of plastic than the bottle, and they're too small for a recycling processor to capture. It just falls through.
Can we recycle the lids of tubs, like a tub of butter?
No, you cannot.
Why?
Well, because you can't recycle the tub of butter anyways. So the quick answer between why you can recycle a bottle or jug with a neck and one that you cannot is because they are made in two different ways. So a recycling processor, most of them are set up. So again, this is the plant that separates recyclables. They are set up to pull out the bottles, not necessarily the tubs. And they're also made in two different ways. That makes the bottle more valuable to be turned into a new product rather than the other tub.
Okay, when you say a bottle with a neck, I'm wondering, what does a neck, I mean, like water bottles, for example.
Right.
Does that have a neck?
It does. So a neck is anything where the opening is smaller than the base of the item.
Okay.
So people have also asked, well, what about detergent bottles, the really large containers where they're set on their side and they're meant to have like a couple of gallons of the laundry detergent? Yes, because it has a neck. So anytime a neck, you can have chubby necks, but a neck is anything where the opening is smaller than the base.
Another question. Jeff says recycling should not be on the consumer. It should be on the manufacturers who are creating this waste to end these problems. For decades, manufacturers have been greenwashing the issue by creating litter campaigns such as Keep America Beautiful. If we really want to solve this problem, we have to hold the manufacturers accountable.
So I would partially agree. I think that it's the responsibility all across the spectrum. I think it's the consumer's responsibility. I think it's manufacturer's responsibility. I think we're all responsible to take care and protect our earth. And I will remind listeners that in the state of Pennsylvania, there is an act called Act 101 that mandates recycling. So we are required by law as consumers to recycle, but I also agree that it is on a social responsibility of manufacturers and distributors as well. However, we, Lixwama, don't have any purview or control over that. That's going to come at the state and federal level, some policy and legislation to require businesses to participate in that process, or they do so out of their own corporate social responsibility. And there are some that do that as well.
And one thing I'd like to point out, and this is a big question with many people, maybe the bigger question, is this is not just a social issue.
Right.
This is a financial issue that with all these contaminants, the changes that have been made, that it is costing consumers more.
That's
why?
Right.
What are the factors?
Well, so I should start that there's always been a cost to recycling. So it has always cost money to collect the material, to take it to a recycling processor where they sort it. They have costs that they have to pay people and equipment and utilities, and then they have to sell that. However, previously, because China was buying the bulk of this materials, they were paying a premium. So we as an industry were getting more money than it cost. So there wasn't that net passed on to consumers. Now the value of recyclables have so plummeted that many processors often have to even pay to sell this material, like selling it rather than getting revenue, they have to pay to get rid of it. Some still has some strong value, corrugated cardboard, things of that nature. And so that cost has to be shared by someone, and it starts with the consumer. So it's always been there. It's just now the value is no longer to offset the cost of processing those materials.
You said earlier, and I have to call you on this one, is you said earlier maybe even cost would go down if more people recycled properly.
Sure.
The only reason I say I have to call you on that is because did the price of anything really go down? But anyway.
Well, so here's the answer to that. So in theory, there's two things that could drive that the cost of recycling could go down to consumers. And it could be driven by two things. One, the more that we as a country invest in infrastructure for recycling, so we build more plastic manufacturing plants, paper manufacturing plants, you've now increased demand, so the value of the product goes back up. Simple economics, supply and demand. Right now, we have way more supply than we have demand locally, so the value is very low. The more you can build demand domestically, the more the value of that commodity will go up. As well as the more we can keep these materials clean and pure when they go to a recycling processor, it lowers their cost. So here's what happens. You deliver dirty materials to a recycling processor. There's a bunch of stuff that's not in there. They have to do a variety of things. They have to slow down their line, so they have to run it slow. They have to add more people on the line, and they have to add more equipment just to try and get a somewhat marketable product. That increases their cost. So if we can increase demand and if we can lower cost, eventually that will be passed on to the consumer as a lower cost for processing recycling.
Couple questions there.
Sure.
When you say demand, are you talking about American consumers' demand for recyclable products?
Correct.
Recycle
yes.
products.
Yes.
I mean, we know there are some people that probably make the conscious effort to buy recycled products. Do more people need to do that?
Yes, sir. So that's one of the ways people ask me, what can I do to help? I'm so passionate about this. There's two things. One, I'm going to say it again, please recycle right. Please, as much as it may pain you, do only put in the bin those four material types. And two, be a conscious consumer. And that comes in two ways. One, when you pick up a product, look to see if it's made from recycled materials. Consumers drive marketing decisions for companies. It's consumer buying power. So look for things made from recycled commodities, and also consider your own use of single-use plastics and materials. The less that we necessarily throw away, the less you'll have the pain around having to put it in your trash versus your recycling bin.
So now that China is not accepting recyclables.
A majority of them.
A majority of them.
Yes,
okay.
Right.
Where are they going?
Right, there's a question. Well, so for some companies, they were able to find some markets in India and Indonesia. For some communities, they've really struggled. So again, this is very regional when it comes to recycling. really what we have, Scott, is an overabundance. There's for many communities and many types of recyclables, there's nowhere for it to go. That's where we're trying to say, keeping in specifically like mixed paper and mixed plastics, there isn't this huge market for them to go, which is why so many communities have stopped accepting them curbside, because there isn't anywhere for them to go.
So there's actually communities across this country that said no recycling.
Yes, and I don't want to propose that this is widely throughout the United States. There are some communities that have, simply because they don't have the resources or the ability or the capacity any longer because the market collapsed. So it is more rare, but there are some communities that have suspended recycling altogether.
Isn't there, when I hear this, I think to myself, well, isn't there an opportunity for... Okay, maybe not a new industry, but an expanded industry here in the United States.
Yes, there very much is opportunity. And we've already begun to see some of that. Some of announcements of some paper mills that will be built here in the country and some plastic mills. But those things take time to come online. So by the time a large corporation decides to build a manufacturing plant, by the time it moves through all the process, you're 2 to 3, 4 years out until that comes online and they're bringing in the volume. So we need more of it. It's just going to take some time to build up that capacity.
Mm-hmm. So we may get to that point in a few years.
Yes, I believe so. Yes. Mm-hmm. And no matter what people tell you, recycling is still worth it. There is economic, social, and environmental value to recycling. It is not going away. This country believes in it. This community believes in it. We just have to we can't go back to the way we did before. We have to look at it in a new way.
Mm-hmm. You know, when you were talking about plastic bottles and plastic bags and all that. I have to say that one of the images that came to mind that we've heard so much about recently is those contaminants in the ocean.
Oh, yes.
In the water. How do they get there? If people are recycling, how do those items get into, get along the roadsides? I mean, I think I know, but get into the water and become such an issue.
Right. So what you're talking about is a large global issue called marine litter. And what I will tell you is that it's not as though in the United States here, you find something in the street, it's going to make its way into the ocean. What most of the time happens is in countries that don't have sophisticated collection infrastructure. So we have a great system here in the United States. You can put your trash out, your recycling out, and typically once a week, your hauler comes by, picks up the material, and off it goes. There are several countries around the world who don't have that type of infrastructure. And some in very rural areas where communities, they will go out and dump their trash in dry riverbeds. And then the rainy season comes in and it washes into a local waterway and then into the ocean. So what you're seeing, and as well as there are some, let's say, processes where there's some ocean dumping, some ships or cargo vessels that are dumping trash into the ocean. That's more where you're getting the marine litter, not that, you see something in the street. It still affects our local waterways, but it's not making its way into the ocean like that large garbage patch that you're thinking of. That's from typically countries that have very, very poor collection and management infrastructure.
We've got a number of emails here. I'm going to get to as many as I can. Donald from Lancaster asks, I'm confused. Waste management says one thing about recycling, and the Lancaster County Recycle Center says another. Who should I listen to regarding recycling?
So, and this is the other thing, is people getting mixed signals. And so what I can say is in Lancaster County, the haulers that we work with, so these are your curbside collection folks, they are all promoting the same message. What is happening is I think a lot of folks still have some old information, some previous materials. Some things might not be quite updated. So what I would say is follow these guidelines of those four material types, and I'll say them again. Plastic bottles and jugs with a neck, metal food and beverage cans, glass food and beverage jars, and corrugated cardboard.
Mm-hmm. I think you may have asked this, or answered this. Someone wanted to know about detergent bottles. Should the lid stay on them?
No, you can throw those away.
Okay. Joelle from Lancaster asked, why doesn't the recycling stations do a better job of educating people and corporations of what not to put into recycling bins?
Couldn't agree with her more, and that's why I'm here, Scott. And really, that's why over the last year we as the County Waste Authority, a significant effort to try and educate people, and we're doing our best and still going at it hard. But I agree, we need much more education.
Paul says, this sounds like a very interesting program. Thanks, Paul. And in many ways can help a lot of things. But at the end of the day, it sounds like it's all about the bottom line and not helping our planet.
So it's a balance. When it comes to recycling, there is a cost associated with it, and we can't ignore that fact. You have to pay people, you have to pay utilities. There is cost associated with that recycling. It's the same thing when you flip on your light. There are costs associated with generating that energy. And at the same time, though, cost shouldn't drive the ultimate decision around protecting our environment. So when we talk about sustainability, and when I was saying at the beginning of the program, helping to make recycling sustainable, you're constantly in this balance of protecting the environment, also keeping things cost effective for folks, while also understanding what communities value. And you're always recalibrating and refiguring whenever there's a disruption. And what happened last year was a huge economic disruption that now we have to recalibrate. Hmm. So it's not all about the bottom line, but you can't ignore that fact.
Chris asked, Lancaster County lists only plastic bottle and jugs with necks as able to be recycled, no triangle numbers. Right. You please clarify. I'm jotting this down. Also, corrugated cardboard is also listed. Are thin packaging boxes able to be recycled, for example, toothpaste boxes or paper towel tubes?
Okay. So on the latter question around, we call that paperboard or grayboard. So no, that material should be thrown away. Corrugated cardboard, you can think of them of like packing boxes, shipping boxes. It's anything where you see a fluted or wavy sheet in between the layers. So that's what should be put in your curbside bin. And I will say in Lancaster County, Dauphin County, York County, folks, when you put material in the trash, it doesn't go into a landfill. We're going to combust it and we're going to make electricity out of it. So we will still extrapolate some value. To the first question around the recycling symbol. So that is not regulated at the local, state, or federal level. Why do I say that? I say that because a manufacturer can decide to put on the recycling symbol for any reason. Sometimes it means that that product was made from recycled material. When you see the recycling symbol with a number, it's communicating the basic chemical composition of that plastic. So a number one is a PET, a number two is an HDPE. It's not saying that, yes, this can absolutely be recycled. It's saying, here's what this product is made out of.
You can see where that would be very confusing for people when they see it in the bottom of a bottle and they see the triangle.
Yes.
Kid asks, many individuals say the recycled materials are going into landfills. Any truth to this?
Not in this community, but in some areas, and that is more the rarity than the norm.
Okay, let's go to Terry in Franklin County. Terry, you're on the air.
Yes, glass is the ideal recycling material, but many trash companies have stopped accepting it because it, quote, contaminates the other recyclables.
Mm-hmm.
What can we do about this? Because I think glass is the ideal recycling material.
All right. Thank you for your call, Terry.
Thanks, Terry. So to some degree, yes, Terry's correct. Glass is infinitely recyclable. The trouble from a transportation and processing perspective is glass can often break down into shards, and in the manufacturing plant, it can actually tear up other materials. So that's why in some communities, they've decided to eliminate the collection and recycling of glass. Here in this region, in Lancaster County, we're still accepting and processing glass, but that would be the reason why some communities, they've actually eliminated glass.
There's a lot to think about here.
We've
got a lot of questions here, and we'll post some of them on our website. But Catherine, I want to thank you very much for being with us today. Advice for consumers out there.
So it's what I said before, two things. Please recycle right. Don't be a wishful recycler. Put only those right four things in the bin and be a conscious consumer. Look for things, buy things made from recycled commodities, and try to reduce your use of single-use items.
Those tags you were putting on recycling bins before, did it say something that you are a wishful consumer? I mean, were you pointing a figure of people that...
They said yay if you recycled right, and they said oops if you didn't,
okay.
And then we communicated to people what was wrong
in
their
bin.
So
you weren't accusing people of being wishful consumer?
No,
wishful,
we were saying oops, there's some things you need to work on.
Catherine Sandeau is the Chief Commercial Officer of Lancaster County Solid Waste Management Authority. Catherine, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF. Your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Coming up on tomorrow's program, we're going to be taking a look at whether fire companies should be able to bill insurance companies when they go out on a call. This is something that has been proposed here in Pennsylvania. It's coming up on tomorrow's program, so be sure to tune in. The Hatfields and McCoys, something that you hear about often in our culture, pop culture. The Hatfields and McCoys had the most famous family conflict in American history on the border of West Virginia and Kentucky in the late 1800s. But there are myths surrounding the feud, as it became known, and led to stereotypes about Appalachia that exist to this day. The American Experience on PBS presents the documentary The Hatfields and McCoys Tuesday night at 9 on WITF-TV. The film's producer, director, and writer, Randall McLowery, talks about the two families and a changing America on today's Smart Talk. Randy McLowery, welcome to the program.
With you.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So, Randall, 130 years after it happened, why the continued fascination with the Hatfields and McCoys?
Well, I think the Hatfield-McCoy feud, you know, captured the imagination of the country at a certain time in history, and then it got basically translated through popular culture and became very much transformed and also became very much part of our culture through it being disseminated into whether it was dime novels kinds of things, silent films, cartoons, and so on. And I think it was a great story. It had all these elements that attracted people and really sort of caught their attention, and it's but then it also sort of became almost a caricature, and it became sort of this sense of, if you wanted to talk about something, about some intractable problem, you know, they're fighting like the Hatfield and McCoys, and this notion that you have these two families that are violent for no reason and have this old never-ending grudge between them that goes on, and so I think it really has sort of become part of the pop culture, part of our cultural heritage, and what has been lost is actually some of the realities behind it in terms of the forces and the social and historical context. It makes it, in my mind, a much richer and compelling story when you really try to understand the story and you sort of peel away the myths and the legends that have been sort of what we have come down to us as the story.
I want to play a clip from the film when you talk about it being part of pop culture. I have to say that this may be the first time Bugs Bunny is mentioned on Smart Talk.
When I was a little kid, I saw a Bugs Bunny cartoon in which there were these two feuding mountaineer families.
Get him, pumpkin head!
The Hatfield and McCoy feud really created the stereotype of the hillbilly in the American popular consciousness. And it was this image of a simple-minded, violent, backward people.
There's a stereotype that these were toothless moonshine and hillbillies taking pot shots at one another, but it couldn't be further from the truth.
Some were bringing was to define the rural as not just different, but in some ways dangerous and problematic.
So that was what you were talking about, Randall, that with the Hatfield and McCoys, that Americans grew up with that became the stereotype for people who lived in Appalachia. How did that happen?
Well, in looking at the story, there was an incident and events happened between these two families, and there was violence that happened, and it came, and the violence occurred at a time when industrialization was really taking over Appalachia, and you had people from the outside coming into the area and looking at this area for exploitation. I mean, this is the time period when America was, in terms of the sort of the industrialization was just expanding rapidly, and the way that you fed that and fueled that was through the natural resources you found in places like the Tug Fork Valley in central Appalachia, rich with coal and timber. And so you have people coming in looking to to exploit that land, exploit those resources. And you had people down there that were behaving in a way that was seen outside of what was seen as civilization and culture and progress at the time, and standing in the way of progress. And while there was violence that did happen, which was related to some degree with some of the changes and transformations that were happening in that society due to the industrialization, there was also looking at this as, in many ways, at that time, in terms of a similar sense of colonization, that you were looking at people that were uncivilized and savages and needed to be fixed. And it was a way, in some ways, that allowed or gave story to dispossessing them of their land and of their resources. And so I think that there's the sense of how the violence got characterized by the press at that time. This was at the beginnings of yellow journalism, where exaggeration of the story was perhaps as important, if not more important, than telling the facts. And so basically you had violence that the press decried, not only the violence, but also sort of in essence the mountain people's entire way of life. And so you have this real shift in terms of how people outside of Appalachia are starting to view this area and this region. And it really caught on. It was the story itself. The feud became, you know, a worldwide sensation, splashed across the headlines across America and beyond. And so I think it's really looking at sort of these transformative moments in this region in terms of how industrialization and capitalism impacted this rural area. And it wasn't just Appalachia, but that's what we focused on our film.
Mm. So the beginning of the feud, I mean, we've often heard, the story has often been that the feud between the Hatfields and McCoys began over ownership of a hog. And that may have been partly to blame, but as the film points out, there's much more to it that goes well beyond or before the ownership of a hog, correct?
Well, there's certainly, you know, in terms of or if you're looking at the arc of what might define the feud. And it's hard to look at this history and to really be definitive about events and things of that nature. There's not a lot of this is recorded, and you have events that are handed down and sort of what happens in terms of that translation as it moves through the generations. But, I mean, a huge impact on that area was the Civil War. And the area along the Tug River, at the time it was the boundary between Virginia and, or Western Virginia area, and Kentucky. And so it became a borderland during the war. And it was, you know, contested on a very kind of visceral level. There were a lot of guerrilla groups on both sides, and there was attacks on people's property and homes, and so that you had a very harmonious community that was disrupted by this event that was obviously not, it was a huge cataclysmic event for the country, but for these areas along the borderlands, they experienced a different kind of a war in the sense that it was there right on their doorsteps. And so, you know, I think that does lead to potential animosities that may translate and filter down. There's no specific evidence that it sparked the feud. One of the patriarchs of the story, Randolph McCoy, his younger brother, was killed. He was a Union. He had joined a Union. And it was said that a guerrilla group that was led by Anderson Hatfield, who was the other patriarch of the feud, had killed him. People look at that and say that may have been part of the story and part of the beginnings of it, but many people do look at the hog trial as potentially the beginning of the story, and that really is a story that's as much about economics as it is about some sort of family grudge.
Mm. Election day, and this may be hard for many people to picture, but election day at that time in the late 1800s, it was a big deal. It was a big social event, but this is one of the key parts of the beginnings of this feud. Take me back to election day when and Ellison Hatfield.
Sure. So it was a Kentucky election day in 1882. And yes, election days were a very big part of the community. This was a very remote area, and while people were neighbors, they weren't necessarily living that close to each other. But this was an opportunity for people of the community to come together and to meet and to socialize, as well as to participate in the voting that was going on and the elections that were happening. This happened along the Tug River, which at that time was the border between Kentucky and West Virginia, and you would have had people from the Tug River community was on both sides of that river, so you would have had people from both sides of that community gathering there, whether or not they could vote in that election or not. And one of Randolph McCoy's son, Tolbert, got into an altercation that led to a fight between himself and Ellison Hatfield, who was Anderson Hatfield, who is commonly known as Devil Anse Hatfield. Ellison was Devil Anse's brother. And it became a very violent and vicious fight, which, while violence was not unheard of during election days, there was a lot of liquor that was being drunk at the time, and brawls and things would occur, but this fight turned violent. And when we look at the film, we look at the fact that Tolbert McCoy, being the son of Randolph, was not as well off as Ellison Hatfield and the Hatfield faction as part of Devil Anse's family. And there might have been some resentments there. Anderson Hatfield had a very successful timber business at that time. And in the end, Ellison Hatfield ended up being stabbed and shot by Tolbert and two of his brothers, and he ended up dying. And Devil Anse Hatfield intervened, apprehended the three McCoy brothers, and basically, you know, meted out his own justice, which was tying them up against some trees by the riverbank and executing them. And so that was, you know, in essence, the real first violent event that occurred in the feud.
Mm. You know, one of the things that strikes me is that in the film, there were some attempts at prosecutions, but I mean, this almost sounded like the Wild West, and it wasn't the Wild West. I mean, it's West Virginia and Kentucky in the 1880s. It's not Tombstone or Dodge City or anything like that. But why weren't there more efforts to prosecute people when people were actually killed?
Well, you know, in reference to how close it was to the Wild West, yes, in terms of proximity to the East Coast, it's much, much closer, but it was a very remote area, and it was very much of a frontier type of place. It, you know, there were places out in the West that had the railroad go through much earlier than the railroad had gotten through that area. So in its own way, it was separated out from being closer to, you know, what you might have had in terms of law, established law enforcement and things like that. But also you had the fact that there was, you know, the river divided this area between two jurisdictions, and it was between two states. And so Devil Anse Hatfield and his family lived on the West Virginia side of the river, and Randolph McCoy and his family lived on the Kentucky side of the river. In both events, the murder of Ellison Hatfield had happened in Kentucky, as well as the murder of the three McCoy brothers. So it was not easy to actually, you know, apprehend and bring Devil Anse and his posse to justice. Required actually crossing into a whole other state, and that led to issues later on, about 5 or 6 years later, when there actually were efforts to extradite them, and that's where the feud kind of ramped up into its second stage. So, you know, I think there was combination of the fact that there wasn't, you know, the proximity of law enforcement was not as easily, you wasn't going to run down the street and get your local policeman to come intervene. And it's not to say that there wasn't law enforcement, there was a justice system and courts and things like that. But yeah, also I think sort of the division along the state lines led to sort of less ability to just sort of hunt them down necessarily, or to apprehend them or to arrest them.
Randall, we only have about a minute left. I want to thank you very much for being with us today, and very much looking forward to seeing the American Experience, the Hatfields and McCoys, tomorrow night at 9 on WITF-TV and throughout the country. What's the takeaway? What do you want viewers to take away from your film?
Well, I think what really is important is that this is a story that's been greatly misunderstood, and that you know, it really is an examination of how an area was impacted by industrialization, and basically a kind of a livelihood had been upended, and that also that this is really a huge event in looking at the creation of the negative images that have plagued this region for pretty much ever since. And I feel in that regard, this is a story that resonates today, you know, as deeply as ever has. Mm-hmm.
Randall McLowry is the producer, director, and writer of the American Experience documentary, The Hatfields and McCoys. And Randy, I think I can call you Randy. You were known as Randy when you were here at WITF years ago. So, or do you go by Randall all the time now?
Randy, Randall, either is fine.
And we got to talk to your wife, who also is a filmmaker a short time ago.
Tracy Heather Strange.
So we are very much looking forward to seeing The Hatfields and McCoys. That's tomorrow night at 9 on WITF-TV. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Scott. I really appreciate it, and thank you again.
We will be, again, looking forward to seeing the film tomorrow night at 11 coming up, tomorrow night at 9, coming up tomorrow on Smart Talk. We'll be talking about whether fire companies can charge insurance companies for their time and efforts. That's on tomorrow's Smart Talk.